I'm Steve Barnes. I am a senior writer, restaurant columnist, and theater critic for the Times Union.
Tell us about your exciting career as a food critic. What do you do?
Well, I'm not actually the food critic. The Times Union has always had someone who strives for anonymity and goes and visits a place and writes, does a formal write-up. I'm the restaurant columnist and blogger. Since 2006, I've been writing the Table Hopping blog, which at its peak was getting about 400,000 visits a month. It's declined a little bit now as things have changed, but it still is a very vigorous presence and remains one of the top two single author blogs at timesunion.com. Our Capital Confidential blog that covers state politics is written by multiple people and it gets more traffic, but restaurants is a busy topic, and a lot of people still come to visit Table Hopping. And I also have additional outlets as well that I've done. So I cover the industry as a beat, just like somebody who's in sports or covers the state politics or, you know, our business desk. I cover restaurants as a beat, openings, closings, and Table Hopping is not, you know, oh, where do I go find the best pasta puttanesca or mocha cheesecake? That's not what I do. You know, I really cover the trends, the surges, the changes, trying to keep track in the past year of everything that was going on with COVID, who was open, who was doing delivery, who was hibernating, that kind of thing. And it really keeps me extremely busy. Because there's both the daily news and churn and larger trends and topic stories.
And is that a typical division in daily journalism to have that kind of split between food writing and restaurant criticism?
Yes, because while in the old days when newspapers had huge staffs, you know, the theater critic could be kept separate from the theater reporter, and it still is at the New York Times and bigger places like that, because they want the critic to believe that they have some insularity, that they're not calling up a producer or a director or an actor and saying, hey, talk to me for my feature story that I'm writing, when I've already dumped all over you and said you're a terrible director. So that division is possible and ideal at bigger institutions, but it is less possible. But unlike in the theater and movies and music and anything else, those don't change just because a critic is there. But when a restaurant critic walks in the door, 1,000 things can change to make that meal increment, and they're recognized. 1,000 things can change to make that meal better for them. You know, you can give them a better table, make sure they get seated, even if you have to take away somebody else's table who's running a little late. You can have the head chef put his or her eye on every single plate that's going out. You can select the most beautiful portion of fish. You can give them the very, very best server that you've got. And you can make sure they're well attended. You might even say, oh, just as a special this evening, we'd like you to try, you know, give them things. So you can make a restaurant dining experience markedly better because you know it's a critic. But an actor at a play is not going to say, oh, the critic's here, I'm going to try harder tonight. It doesn't work that way. And so it still is important that a critic have independence. And this way also, frankly, I can talk to people. I can have my face out there. I can be literally the face of Times Union food coverage. My face has been printed at the top of my blog for 15 years. And this makes me, in a small restaurant world, recognizable. And it's almost impossible for me to go into a restaurant and not be recognized. And, you know, it also causes things like in the supermarket, people will take a photo of my shopping basket so they can post it on social media and say, hey, look what we caught Steve Barnes from the Times Union buying. And this, I will admit, this does disincline me from buying Fritos.
Yeah. How did you get started as a food writer?
Well, I've always covered the arts. That's where I've been in journalism maybe 30 years this summer. And 2 years prior to that as an intern, I've always covered the arts and I continue to. The food thing came along because I grew up in a restaurant. My father had a restaurant in Schenectady from the mid-70s to the mid-80s called the Oxbow Inn. It was down on the very bottom of State Street near SUNY Schenectady. And so I grew up in the business and I had that background there. And my first newspaper job, I did occasional restaurant reviews when the regular critic was off. And then at the Times Union, I saw that, sure, the food stories might do restaurant trends occasionally, but the restaurant news was relegated basically to three little short items that somebody happened to send in the mail or via email that then ended at the appeared at the end of the restaurant review each week. You know, it's just like, hey, this opened, hey, he's doing a wine dinner, that kind of thing. And I knew there was a lot more out there. But the Times Union powers that be didn't understand back in the early 2000s when they're handing out blogs to everybody that a restaurant blog could sustain. They're like, how can you find enough news? And I guaranteed them there was. And in the early years when I was really cranking things out and there was a lot less competition in terms of food coverage, I was getting every story. So I was posting anywhere between 12 and 20 times a day. And that was just blog posts. I was also writing stories. And then stories generate stories because people see things you put out and they say, hey, well, what about me? I've got an interesting story. And then you meet interesting people. And it tentacles from there. And it is, I mean, the restaurant industry in the United States was projected, at least for 2020, before 2020 happened, was projected to be a $900 billion a year industry. And for instance, it has something like 30 times the number of employees as the airline industry. And in all airlines, including cargo, there's about 17 carriers operating in the United States, and there's 600,000 restaurants. So the airlines are too big to fail, and the restaurants, in many cases, are too small to save. So there's a lot out there. There's just it's a vast world that there is to cover. And you know, as much as I love the arts, there's a sad fact that everybody needs to eat three times a day, or you know, at least twice or something. Everybody needs to eat, but nobody has to consume the arts. Nobody dies if they don't hear Beethoven.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, in your opinion, what's the essential role of a restaurant in our daily life? You talked about the broader view of the economy, but I mean, how does a restaurant figure in day to day? A good restaurant, you know, not just food that you eat because you'll die otherwise, but what's the gold standard?
Restaurants occupy niches throughout the 24-hour life cycle of a community. Because you know, you've got late night diners for cops or third shift workers or whatever, and you've got breakfast spots for people getting up early. You know, you've got lunch for people who used to have business lunches back in the pre-pandemic days. And then you've got dinner, and dinner can either be, you know, a couple of parents working late, picking up food on the way home, whether it's takeout or whether it's grab and go, prepared meals, or it can be just a quick bite. It couldn't be a stop before a show. It could be a celebratory meal. You know, maybe you're getting a burger before you go in to see something at the Times Union Center, or maybe you want to do 9 courses at Yono's because it's Valentine's Day or it's your 40th anniversary. Or so they really function in so many ways in restaurants. Because people, if they're not actually busier than they were 50 years ago, there's some debate about that, but they believe they're busier, and it has just become easier to have food that's made and prepared outside of the house and is easily available to you. So the restaurants serve many, many functions.
This all seems very glamorous as a writer, but there's a danger, isn't there? Didn't a disgruntled owner once put out a hit on you a few years back?
Well, I can laugh because it's completely ridiculous. My colleague, Fred LeBron, who still writes a column for the Times Union and has actually been a Times Union employee for more than 50 years, he covered the original Woodstock in 1969 for the Times Union. And Fred still writes for us and still contributes a little wine recommendation thing every week in our food section. Fred used to be the restaurant critic, and he got a dead fish sent to him in the mail. And yes, the restaurant owner did this. The headline is a restaurant owner hired a mixed martial arts fighter to attack me. But it wasn't over a review. He was upset, thought I'd embarrassed him because I reported the truth that he was temporarily closed because he'd forgotten to renew his liquor license. And I initially reported what he told me was that there was a water main break. And then I got a call from the state liquor authority that said, no, he forgot to renew his liquor license. So he's got to renew it. And liquor license is simply mailing in the check and the form. He just forgot to do it. But he thought that made him look dumb. So he told the staff a lie. He got found out. And such was his personality and temperament and acquaintances that he hired a pro MMA fighter to attack me. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't that bad, except as, you know, an affront to journalism. I had a black eye and I was beat up and I needed to get new glasses. But, you know, eventually it came out and there was a trial. The restaurant owner was tried for conspiracy. Now, he was acquitted because it was all circumstantial, but I heard from jury members afterwards privately that the way they were instructed by the judge and the way the law read, they could not convict him, but they all fully believed that he was guilty. And so in my mind, which is why I didn't say any of this was alleged to start this story, in my mind, he's guilty. Everybody knows it. It happened. And if anything, it strengthened my resolve in journalism. And as these things happened, he went to prison soon after for tax evasion anyway.
I have scrupulously avoided Stuyvesant Plaza ever since that happened. It's just too dangerous over there. I stick to North Central Troy.
Yes, exactly. Well, that was what you sort of stole my next line, which is I've lived on the edges of Albany, some of Albany's worst neighborhoods for 25 years. And the worst thing that ever happened to me ever in my life was getting my ass kicked in the parking lot of Stuyvesant Plaza, where they have stores like Peaches and Cream and Joseph A. Banks.
Yeah. Well, you put your guard down in a situation like that.
You do.
That was a detour, but thank you for that little blast from the past. But here we are in a moment that's, you know, not a brief, desperate moment, but a year-long one. We're coming up on the anniversary. It is the anniversary of the COVID impact on our economy and in the restaurant world. Can you give us a quick assessment of the state of the restaurant economy around here?
Sure. Well, the restaurant shutdown as ordered by Governor Cuomo took effect at 8 p.m. last March 16th. It was a Monday. And as of 8 p.m. on March 16th, dining rooms and bars were closed. Restaurants could only do takeout. Now, the state responded really quickly. Normally, things change at an eternally slow pace in the state, but the state liquor authority, working with the governor's office, very quickly also allowed takeout for alcohol. Alcohol, previously, the only thing you could take out of a restaurant was you could buy a six-pack of beer, or you could take home a bottle of wine that you hadn't finished as long as it was corked and put in a sealed bag. Well, they changed the law to allow you to do anything a restaurant sold. So, you know, cocktails, beer, bottles of wine, any of that could be sold with along with takeout. And so that helped them for mid-March. Outdoor dining again started at the beginning of June. Indoor dining, at least upstate, at a 50% capacity started in mid-June. So restaurants have slowly been coming back, but then things ebbed and flowed. And as the second wave of the pandemic started up, other places went back to doing delivery only. And so there's been surges and waves and creativity and great adaptability on the part. And so far, what they can see nationwide is they estimate more than 100,000 restaurants have closed. It's unclear how many of those are permanent. But of the approximately 600,000 restaurants at the beginning of 2020, now there's 5. And while the restaurant industry was at $863 billion in 2019, and was projected to jump up to $900 billion for 2020, that actual figure for last year now looks like they've not fully reconciled the numbers, but down to $650 billion. So $250 billion, a quarter of $1 trillion gone out of the economy as a result of lost business to restaurants. And locally, we have seen many closures, But what I found really remarkable, because I've been keeping a tally for more than a decade of openings and closings. I don't usually track chains unless it's like the first arrival of a chain. The Duck Donuts chain, for instance, brought its first franchise here last year. And so I noted that. But if a Starbucks or a Dunkin' opens and closes, I don't track that. But so primarily among independent restaurants, historically, say a normal year like 2019, there might be 100 openings and 70 closings. Last year, there were about 55 closures that were permanent that I could confirm. Some may still be hibernating. The fallout of that we may not see, but there were only 55 confirmed closings, but there were still 70 openings, which was remarkable to me, including things like Albany got its first Nigerian restaurant, got its first African restaurant, sub-Saharan African restaurant, where there's a Nigerian restaurant on Lark Street. Previously, you couldn't find any food from sub-Saharan Africa anywhere in the capital region on a regular basis, except one restaurant that about 5 years ago started doing one Ethiopian dish. But here we have a dedicated Nigerian restaurant on Lark Street. And so there still is this desire. And with the pandemic-related closures, there was a bunch of real estate. And if somebody was walking in and had some money, a landlord sure as heck was going to sign them up. And it doesn't, if you want to start making cars, you have to be as rich as Elon Musk. I mean, that's a capital intensive process, but it's relatively easy and inexpensive to open a restaurant, particularly if you've got an existing location. You just need to, you know, get the necessary permits and bring in food and take out containers and open the door. And so that's what that ease of entry or comparative ease of entry is what, and the dream to own a restaurant is what causes people to still do it.
I'm trying to make sense of those numbers. Does that mean that things are going relatively well for restaurants in spite of the
pandemic? Well, I mean, restaurants, no, they've hung on. You know, I've heard many, many restaurant owners have said, well, I used my retirement savings to keep us open for the past year. You know, a lot of their employees didn't want to come back to work in June because they were still getting the extra $600 on top of their regular unemployment. They didn't feel safe and they were getting a lot of money. So owners have absolutely suffered. I mean, their business was off, you know, 50%. And it still hasn't rebounded. I had somebody tell me recently, just earlier this month, that they did more business in 3 days of Valentine's weekend than they had in all of January. And so people are suffering. Restaurants are suffering. Places that used to have two bartenders every night and three on a Friday and Saturday will now have one, maybe two for a few hours on Friday. They've seriously cut back on staff. A lot of them have limited their menus so they don't have to have as much inventory on hand. No, they're suffering like crazy. They desperately need aid. They just don't know how long they held on for the, you know, PPP and other assistance programs. And they're really hoping that there will be a restaurants dedicated aid within the next federal bailout package that's coming. They're taking advantage of any sort of grants they can find. I mean, they're really scrambling and they're hurting. And, you know, some of them, I had one person tell me they figured retirement, which was coming in 5 years, is now likely to be 10 years so they can put back the money they've spent to keep their place open.
And do you find that there's a kind of restaurant that's doing better under the circumstances, like the drive-through or the takeout place, a place that's already set up for that as opposed to having to adapt?
Yes. Well, yes, because so many people switch to takeout. But just about everybody had to learn to adapt. Some of them changed their menus. For example, there's a restaurant in Troy that was, you know, considered the hippest and in many eyes the best restaurant in Troy, called Pex Arcade. But it was a funky, cool place with lots of small plates, heavy interaction, a chef counter where they just handed you the food over to you, and you get multiple courses and wine pairings with it. And then the pandemic came, and it was completely not, that style of food dining experience was not at all adaptable to takeout. And so as much as and that was a chef-driven restaurant, and as much as they loved that restaurant, they killed it off. They replaced it with Italian, because that, you know, pizza or pasta, chicken parms, all of that stuff is much easier to make in bulk, much easier to package. It travels better. And when people are looking for, in times of stress, people do look for comfort food as opposed to really adventurous stuff most of the time. And they've done well with that, especially since the Lucas Confectionery and Little Pex and others that are affiliated with that as part of Clark House Hospitality in Troy have shut down and now are only doing takeout again. So they're not even doing dining in. So for them, they've been able to adapt. And even the owner was even riding around on his Vespa in better weather, doing deliveries himself. And so everybody has adapted to a degree. And those that felt they weren't just closed, like Cornell's in Schenectady. Although I just got finished saying Italian travels well, Cornell's in Schenectady decided they didn't want to try to adapt, and they simply closed. It was one of the first permanent closures last year at the beginning of the pandemic. They said, we're not going to try. It's not worth it when we don't want to hang on because we don't know how long this is going to last. So there have been some victims, but there's also been, all sorts of success stories. Places that had never done takeout before were doing, like Jack's Oyster House is 114 years old in Albany. And that was always a fancy fine dining place that maybe occasionally did takeout, but it was considered a hassle. And since early December, they've been doing 3-course meals that you order during the week for pickup between 5 and 7 p.m. on Friday to Sunday nights. And that's been their business for the past 3 months.
We're speaking with Steve Barnes. Amongst his many roles at the Times Union, he's a food writer. You're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Steve Pierce. Steve, you recently wrote in the Times Union about the rise of a new restaurant phenomenon, ghost restaurants. What is a ghost restaurant?
Okay, a ghost restaurant is basically, it's delivery only. In rare cases, you can pick up from there, but it's usually delivery only. So you don't know where the physical location is. And when this first started, it was in big cities, and an operator might have 5 separate menus. And they all came out of the same kitchen, cooking 5 separate menus for 5 separate niche audiences. In a dense place like, New York, Chicago, Boston, that made sense. And in fact, in Albany now, there is one of them called the Cloud Food Hall. And it happens to be in downtown Albany. They do pickup. But, at this point, I think they're up to like 7 concepts from, soul food to Korean and barbecue and healthy salads and burgers. And it all comes out of the same kitchen. So if our conception of a restaurant was, well, what kind of restaurant is it? It's a steakhouse. It's a sushi restaurant. It's New American. It's vegetarian. Now, and it's in one location, that's where you go for that. Now there's no actual location. It comes to you. So it's sort of, like the equivalent of an online retailer like Amazon, where you can get anything. And in its ideal form, it's great for the consumer because they have lots of options. It's good for the business owner because they can go after different markets without having to have multiple locations because real estate is expensive. They also don't have to worry about servers or front of house or making it look pretty. They need a kitchen and easy access for drivers and a good front door that people can go in and out of all day while they're doing deliveries. However, it's gotten a bit corrupted in my view. And this is I have no objection in concept to ghost kitchens because, as I mentioned, the Cloud Food Hall in Albany is an independent guy who started in Troy with sort of a food hall, food court, a bunch of independent operators around a central large space. And he went to strictly takeout and delivery with his next concept. That's an independent operator who had this idea. He's making it work, and it's the future because it's ordering through the app. I like that. I also like, I've read stories of like a pizza place in New York City that had extra dough, started making bread out of their pizza dough, and they developed a sandwich brand. But instead of having people have to navigate through the pizza menu to find their sandwiches where they're relegated at the bottom and nobody buys them. They created a whole separate brand. So instead of Dom's Pizza, it would be Dom's Sandwiches. And you thought of it as a separate restaurant, it's a separate menu. And it was all sorts of different funky, creative sandwiches. And this was another source of revenue that they could market in a different way for a different audience, probably than pizza. And that works for them. And that's great. But the way ghost kitchens have been co-opted, at least to my mind, is the way they've been taken over by celebrities. There's companies out there that approach celebrities, say, we've got the infrastructure to do this, lend your name to it, give us a type of food you like, and then we'll take existing restaurants, usually chains that are slower now because of the pandemic, and we'll put you in there. And what this makes possible is there's this kid who's a YouTube star. He's 22 years old. He's not had nothing to do with food whatsoever. And he does stunts. Like, he does a speeded up video of him counting to 100,000. And he does other crazy things. And sometimes he just gives away money. Sponsors give him money. And he walks into a charity and hands them 50 grand. And this developed him 50 million followers to the Mr. Beast YouTube channel. Well, he partnered with one of the big ghost kitchen companies, and in one day, on one single day in December, launched 300 Mr. Beast burgers locations nationwide, and they all went into mass chain restaurants, and in the capital region, it happens to be the Buca di Beppo restaurant on Wolf Road, because Buca di Beppo is giant portions, and it's usually big parties going out for Italian. Well, a lot of that wasn't happening. And so Buca di Beppo had a big available kitchen, and they had kitchen staff. So their corporate parents have made the agreement all over the country to do things like these ghost kitchen driven by celebrity. Now, you know, people dream for years and years and years of opening their own restaurant, and they scrimp and save and do it all themselves. And here's a 22-year-old kid with no experience launching, you know, a burger concept 300 communities nationwide on the same day. That just offends me. Similarly, what just happened in the capital region is Guy Fieri, who at least in his defense has been a chef and restaurant owner for 25 years, but is now mostly known as a star on Food Network. Guy Fieri launched more than 100 locations of his Flavor Town. Flavor Town is one of Guy's catchphrases. You know, like Emeril was always bam. Well, Flavor Town is Guy Fieri's, you know, bold, explosive flavor. And he does, you know, Flavor Town Kitchen, which has a total of like a chicken sandwich, a burger, a couple of salads, some really sort of sloppy, messy apps. There's maybe 15 things total on the menu. And he started at 100 restaurants nationwide. And again, he's going into Buca di Beppo. So it's all driven by celebrity. This kid, Mr. Beast, has 50 million followers who are going to try some of his food because they like his brand. You know, Guy Fieri's fans are going to say, hey, we know Guy Fieri. Well, let's go to Flavor Town. Let's order it. And that, to my mind, that is taking away money from people like Corey Nelson, who opened Cloud Food Hall in Troy Kitchen. It's also taking away from independent restaurants like, say, Cafe Capriccio in Albany that... you know, is doing lots of takeout. It's taking money away from Crave Burgers in Albany, which does outstanding burgers and delivery. And, you know, why somebody would order from Guy Fieri or Mr. Beast instead of Crave, where I can tell you who the chef is, where he gets his product, and how much he cares. I can't tell you a thing about Mr. Beast or Guy Fieri other than what's on their websites.
So what you're describing sounds like just an acceleration of everything everywhere, where you have venture capital defining a concept and then mobilizing their financial resources to rent unused kitchen space in various markets. And you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with food. It could be anything.
Right. Right. If there were a way to, as I said earlier, if they could figure out a way to make cars cheaply out of unused car plants, they would do that. But food is cheap because all you have to do, once you've got this in place, you're going to have central production kitchens that are making, you know, Guy Fieri's jalapeno poppers, which are stuffed with andouille sausage and pimento cream cheese and wrapped in bacon. So they're making these by the millions, freezing them, and then FedEx trucks come and take them to the 100 locations of Flavortown. So whatever that possibly could be, but food is easy to do that. Since the infrastructure is in place to get food fast all over the country, it's there, something they can do, and then they explode it off a celebrity. And so, one of the other ones is Paulie G, who was on that lamentable Jersey Shore TV show. He has a Subs concept that's running out of chain restaurants. Mariah Carey has a cookies concept. That all it is Mariah Carey's name. She probably sat in an office, tasting five cookies and said, I like those, maybe less, pecans. And then Mario Lopez does Mexican. And it's all ghost kitchen. It's all driven by celebrity. And it's all driven, to my mind, by corporate cynicism and an opportunity to make a buck off the backs of the little guys.
Yeah, it's interesting. But there's always been a pretty breathtaking sweep in the restaurant industry, right? You have everything, say, locally, from the little Lebanese restaurant in Cohoes that popped up in a tiny little storefront where there's clearly, American dream of becoming not rich, but just having a decent living, cooking real food
with her mother-in-law's recipes.
Right. So that's a classic story. But then you also have Matt Baumgartner, who just really, he thinks up concepts. He I'm not a restaurant person at all, but I go there and I go, this was really conceptualized as a place for people to hang out. It really isn't about food. It's about a fun place to go with your friends and drink. And he figured out how to do that, and he replicates it, and it's successful. But it's not anything like the restaurant, the Lebanese restaurant in Cohoes.
Right. And, Matt would be the first one to say that, because while he adores fine dining, he also recognizes it's a pain in the ass, and it's hard to make money at it, because the money is in booze. And so, he has... out at his place in June Farms in West Sand Lake, that is much more of an event venue where he has a glorious pizza oven and good people cooking for him. So there's more interesting things there, but it still is that they're more about the social than they are about the food. When you go into a place like the Mexican Market on Central Avenue or Joaquina Triqui, in Albany, it's sort of like a little general store, or La Mexicana in Schenectady, a little general store with a few cafe tables, and they're trying to serve people the food from food of their culture that represents who they are. And you're right, that is conceptually very, very different from, hey, let's turn on soccer, I'll sell you liters of beer, we can throw peanut shells on the floor, and we're going to make some money on this. But the downside of that is, in a pandemic, it turns out, when you can't gather people for soccer, Matt Baumgartner has probably suffered more than a lot of other people, because it just wasn't adaptable to takeout. Sure, they tried to do growlers and stuff, but the whole point of gathering for soccer is completely impossible when you can't have 150 people in there shouting at their team and hugging each other and when they score goals. So it's he did very well for a long time, and I think he's having to reconceptualize to figure out what'll happen going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting. Then you also have the sort of the hybrid where you, like Terra Kitchen, where you have that grassroots model to start, but they clearly had an idea of expansion from the beginning and the energy and the smarts to do it.
Yes, and Anisa Waheed is one of the most impressive entrepreneurs, I think, in any field in the capital region. She is a great success story. She's very driven. She's savvy. She makes good food and has additional things coming down the pike. So I do like the ease of entry to the restaurant field. It is quite accommodating, depending on what you want to do and how you see it. And I hate chain restaurants. I'm on the record as saying that. This doesn't apply to Anisa Waheed and Tara Kitchen, because she's only got three. But you know, I hate chains because, to my mind, they don't have souls. They're clones, and a clone can't have a soul. And if the fact that you can get the same thing at an Olive Garden in Sarasota or Saskatoon, that to me is bad. I want to find something like a Tara Kitchen. I want to find something, you know, like the little Lebanese restaurant. You know, I want to go into a wine bar on 2nd Street in downtown Troy, or go across the street to an oyster bar where somebody who's got a PhD and works in banking just loves oysters, and her wife is a cocktail wizard. And then they open this funky little place where you can get great cocktails and oysters. And so, you know, I appreciate that. And one of the things that I've noticed as a similarity between the two industries I primarily cover, arts and restaurants, is that the creativity they both exhibited, you know, restaurants and just figuring out what to do differently, how to make themselves appealing, how to accommodate, how to please their customers, how to keep their staff employed to the degree that they could, and the arts pivoting as much as they could to online stuff. Aaron Marquise, who runs the Creative Circus company in Troy, has been doing some streaming content. And the Troy Foundry Theater has also been offering content in the last year, and they've just announced their new season as well. So the adaptability has been really rewarding to see, and certainly given me plenty to cover.
Now, I was really struck in your piece about ghost restaurants that at the end, there's an impassioned appeal to the reader not to patronize these places. Did you get any feedback from that?
Very little. And one of them was someone who acknowledged she was the wife of a cook at Buca di Beppo. And so her husband was benefiting from, you know, being back to full time, because these ghost kitchens were allowing him to get, you know, full and sometimes full work weeks, sometimes overtime, because he was doing Mr. Beast Burgers and Guy Fieri, and to whatever capacity they are doing Buca di Beppo. But really interestingly, I noticed the Guy Fieri thing just blazed across social media and did really, really well for the Times Union, both on our website and on our Facebook page, where there were hundreds of links and comments. But while many people were like, tagging their friends, "Hey, Jennifer, we got to try this because we love Guy Fieri," the people who actually commented, most of them were negative, whether it was people saying, "I'd never try this, this is a terrible idea, support locals," or they're saying, "We tried it and it was bad." And so, you know, I really think my case is defensible here. Guy Fieri and the guy behind Mr. Beast don't need your money. They don't. And their corporate overlords don't need your money. They've got plenty of it. If you can launch 300 locations at once, selling 10 different kinds of burgers and shakes and fries, then you don't care about food. And I want to give my money to people who care about food.
And do you think that there is a qualitative difference between what these chain ghost restaurants are doing and Corey Nelson's cloud operation in Albany? Is that a more authentic, you know, food restaurant as opposed to a marketing concept?
Now, I have no doubt, because these are big companies and they, you know, they probably have food experts. They, I'm sure, spend months developing the recipes. And I have no doubt somebody believes in the, I don't think they're not snidely whiplash, twirling their mustaches and saying, "Ha ha ha, we're going to take people's money with shitty food." I mean, that just doesn't, it's not going to happen. But I think the intention behind it is different. I know Corey. I've known Corey since he was struggling to get Troy Kitchen open. And he has been knocked down so many times for regulatory issues and other problems and changes in business. And if he were a boxer, he would have had 20 standing eight counts already. And yet Corey's back on his feet trying. And he says, you know, he's got a big vision, and he seems to me a success story. So is this a mass concept that do we want to get as many different kinds of food to as many people as possible. On that superficial level, is it the same? Yes. Because before the pandemic started, or really became clear how bad it was going to be, Corey was talking about having 20 cloud food halls. So nothing was ever more than 10 minutes from your house. You know, there'd be one in downtown Albany, and there'd be one in uptown Albany, and there'd be one in Gilderland, and there'd be three in Rotterdam, and two in Schenectady, and two in Latham, and four in Colony, and five in Clifton Park. So everything was 10 minutes away. You know, it would just be at your door. You press go, and within 10 minutes of pressing go, 15 minutes at the latest, your food is at your door. That was Corey's grand dream. Is that workable? Is that possible? Mm-hmm. I would love to watch that grow from the ground up. That to me is self-built by somebody with ambition. It's not presto, here's 300 at once.
So this was a trend that was starting before the pandemic. It's not on the short list of.
Yes, yeah. Because what they found in New York City is it was just easier to do five concepts without having to do front of house service, and with the density of Manhattan, you know, you could just blanket your nearby neighborhoods with delivery people on bicycles or scooters.
Yeah.
But it worked really well for the pandemic. So that part largely explains why it has exploded. And they think by 2030, this could be, ghost kitchens could be twice the annual revenue of full service restaurants.
And these things are, it's interesting when you talked about the back end of it. These are frozen products that are shipped out of a central commissary, or these are recipes that are replicated locally at the restaurants?
I imagine it's a mix of both. But I guarantee you the staff at Buca di Beppo is not splitting jalapeno peppers, stuffing them with andouille sausage and pimento cream cheese, and then wrapping them bacon and then sticking them in the oven or the deep fryer. I guarantee you that's not happening. Is it all boil in the bag stuff? Hopefully. I mean, I'm assuming that they're actually cooking the burgers fresh, or, I mean, they may be frozen burgers, but I'm assuming they're cooking them, you know, to order, as opposed to, you know, the chicken or faux chicken that you'll get at Subway that is, you know, some sort of preformed protein thing that has fake grill marks on it that they just microwave. So I believe this, at least some of this is put together to order. How much of it is frozen, I don't know. But for something like, in addition to Corey Nelson, there's a place in Colony called Baba's Delivery Kitchen that has a pizza concept, a chicken and a halal concept. And then over at Viaport Rotterdam, there's one that has one, it's called Jam's Lunch, is the official place with a storefront where you can, you know, sit down and get some food there. But then they've got four other concepts: Mexican wraps, burgers, and fish. And I'm sure a lot of that has to be frozen, because to have that many ingredients on hand, you can't keep all of that stuff fresh. So for that inventory, a lot of it needs to be frozen. But at least on the local level, I believe they're not buying a pre-existing Cisco burger that they're just putting fresh lettuce on a bun.
Yeah, well, after I read your article, I checked out the Guy Fieri online menu, and I looked at that jalapeno appetizer, and I thought, And then I thought, oh, what would my cardiologist say? And that's pretty much what the whole menu is like. That, you know, it's devised.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Not fine. Not
fat,
not,
and salt.
Yeah. So we're coming to the end, and I know this because it's almost mealtime. But before we go, I wonder if you could gaze in your crystal ball and suggest what you think the in the local restaurant industry, particularly, what do you think is the short term future, and then in the long run, what's going to come out of all this?
Short term is, people are going to start sitting outside as soon as possible, because what Valentine's weekend showed us is that people are desperate to get out of the house, and Valentine's was a good excuse. Places like Jack's Oyster House, which they'd only been doing takeout, they opened for in-house dining for Valentine's weekend only. And more than a week before the weekend, they sold out all 3 days, completely filled up. And so people really want to be out. And I think, whereas in the past, restaurants might have thought, oh, you know, we'll wait till April 30th to put out our tables. I think as soon as it's 40 degrees and not raining, people are going to be clamoring to sit outside. So that will be, and municipalities have been really good about that. You know, Waterleaf, for instance, because it's a small community and can do this, basically said, oh yeah, hey, just call City Hall and we'll let you shut down the street in front of your restaurant. We'll let you take over the whole side. Albany was always very strict with its outdoor seating and the inspectors going around and measuring things and all sorts of stuff. They completely relaxed it. They even took places where they shut down the parking lanes, the curbside parking lanes, so restaurant tables could occupy the complete sidewalks, and then they put up barriers so then the parking lanes became the sidewalks where pedestrians could walk. That happened in a variety of places. There was a street blocked off downtown Albany, Troy, 2nd Street, and also around the corner on Broadway between 2nd and 3rd was shut down just to fill those spaces with outdoor tables. And that is going to come back. That's going to be the real lifeline, because we don't know how long it's going to take for the next federal stimulus and aid packages to come through, and exactly what they'll entail and how fast the restaurants are going to get them and how much they're going to get. Because who knows? I mean, if you lost a third of your annual revenue last year, are you going to make that up in one check from the federal government? Probably not. So the near term outdoor dining, as much as possible, continued takeout, continued flexibility, adaptability. And in the next 6 months, as more and more people get vaccinated, once we get up to what we believe to be, you know, what's the safety level, 75% or so, that more people will feel safe to go back out, then we'll see the shakeout. Places that had been hibernating may just slowly go away, and you'll start seeing for rent signs going up on windows for places that still have Facebook pages up but haven't been in business for 12, 13, 14 months. The long term, I think takeout will continue to be a big thing, because people really like it. And the way the communities have battled back against the big delivery services capping what had been just criminal fees, saying you cannot charge restaurants this much just because they need you. You can't really just abscond with that money. So places will continue to be adapted to takeout and delivery because people have liked it, you know, in the way that I started getting grocery delivery, not because of the pandemic, but I think it was just because at one point I was lazy and I was like, hey, I want to try this. And I really liked grocery delivery. And then throughout the pandemic, I wasn't scared. I didn't have to go out. My grocery shopping was always, you know, during my commute. On the way home from work, I'd stop at the grocery store. But since I've been working from home for 11 months, going on a year now, you know, I wasn't going out. And so I started getting grocery delivery, and now I'm accustomed to it. It's something that I like. I certainly have gotten more food delivery just because it's convenient. And I think places will accommodate to that. But I also do think that there will be newer and younger people coming in because of available spaces. And there should be a surge in culinary and conceptual creativity coming into 2022 and beyond, as people take what they've learned during the pandemic and say, we're going to try some things. Because what did we learn? There's a whole lot of different ways to do things that we didn't know were possible. So why not? And the restaurant industry, as I said earlier, is relatively easy to get into. So why not try it?
Cool. Well, something to look forward to. Anything you want to add? We've had a long discussion here, but it sounds like there's always more.
Oh, no, I'm good. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Well, thanks so much, Steve. I'll be looking for you in the newspaper.
All right. Very good.
Okay. Take care. Thank you.